I'm very happy to welcome Dave Scheinberg as our keynote speaker.
Thank you.
Dave's...
that's plenty.
That's plenty?
Yeah, that's great.
Dave has a long and storied history, which we won't go into. Right,
it's probably a longer talk than I have time for, so that's fine. In any case, I do want to thank Gary for inviting me to do this. He sent me an email some time ago and said, you know, he puts this word keynote in there. I thought he was using it like people use the word PowerPoint. You want to give a PowerPoint presentation. What's that?
I invited
you. You invited me. But Gary first sent something, and then you asked me for the title, which was the second part of my introduction, but that's okay. So you invited me, Terry. So you said the keynote. That's fine. The story doesn't change. That means that maybe you heard that I finally made the plunge and bought my first Macintosh, and I was supposed to use Keynote to give some talk. That's what I thought you meant. But I had no idea it was really a keynote. Now, the bottom line is that I actually run Parallels on this silly thing and still use Windows to give these talks, but that's okay. So it's not really a keynote presentation. But then, Terry, you definitely did, and maybe you didn't invite me. I apologize for that. Ask me for the title, and like any other time, you know, you think, okay, it's months in advance, title. So I came up with the title, Time Scales and Recognition Dynamics, Physiology and Behavior. The good thing about sometimes just coming up with the title and trying to make it fit is even if you haven't really worked out what you're going to say, it gets you going thinking about some topics like that. So hopefully today we will move through some topics that are related to the work that goes on in this center, and we'll see how it flies. I'll start by telling you the problems I'm most interested in, and I'm interested in how the brain sees a complex world. But the truth is I'm actually interested in how we or how animals see a complex world. And by that, what I really am most interested in is how we know what's out there. What is it that's going on out there? Now, sometimes this problem's easy. You know, if I tell you to sit tight, it's going to be a dark room, there's going to be a fixation spot, and just tell me what's out there, it doesn't take you very much information. I don't know if you saw that. I didn't. But in any case, you probably saw that it was Winnie the Pooh. Didn't take much. And you could see that very easily. Now, the things are a little bit more difficult if the scene has a little bit more stuff going on. So if instead of a single stimulus flash for a moment, I put up a little scene that's a little bit more interesting, you still find your way to Pooh. It takes you some time, presumably that over the course of that time, you'll look around and then you'll hone in on the items in the scene that you know. And of course, even at a longer time scale, in the real world, things aren't even like this. This is still just a flashed up picture, but you might find your way in front of the screen where you're watching some nice little video, and there you see out in the distance your friends, and there's Pooh doing his thing. He's walking around. He, like the rest of us, just had lunch. He's eating it right now. And we can recognize this, of course, over an extended period of time. So these are the kinds of time scales that I'm interested in, how it is that we come to know what's out there in the world. And the question comes, how you go about studying that question. And the way I have mostly done it in my laboratory with the people that work with me is to try to combine two things. One of them being behavior, that is evidence that we know what's out there in the world, with something going on in the brain, neural activity that we can record. And we record that activity most of the time, in our case, with microelectrodes that allow us to actually record what's going on deep in the brain, where the cells live and where we think much of the computation that drives these kinds of behaviors actually can be understood to some level. And of course, while we look at behavior, we look at things like how well an animal might do, or how long a particular task might take, or where our eyes go over time. Now, one question comes up with the particular problem I presented is where you might be interested in studying in the brain. And for this, we can go back quite some time, over 120 years ago, a paper from a group in England, Brown and Schaefer, who were looking at effects of lesions. So this is a very old paper, but it's quite interesting the results they found, and they fit quite well with what we know today, and that is they were investigating the effects of lesions of the occipital and temporal poles of the monkey's brain, and in this particular case, this is case number 6, they did a complete removal of both the right and then a few days later the left temporal lobes. And in doing so, you could ended up with a lesion that looks like this. It's really a rather complete temporal lobe, and on the medial side as well. So this is the medial portion and the lateral portion. The animal recovered quite well, but what's of most interest to me is what they say here below. This animal gives evidence of hearing, seeing, and of the possession of his senses generally, but it's clear that he no longer understands the meaning of the sounds and the sights and the other impressions that reach him. So somehow he has an intact perceptual system that can't quite reach what it means for him to actually recognize and understand the things out there. And so it is over the last 100 or so years, many of us have begun to explore the properties of this part of the brain. And again, the tool that I primarily have relied on is the single electrode, where we can lower that electrode, or sometimes multiple electrodes in this area, and record activity of cells. And when you do that, what do you find? These are, I'm sure most of you know, rasters where I've sorted the activity that we can pick up on a single electrode. And this would be the extracellular trace, a single trace. And in general, we don't show lots of these. What we do is we break these down into the time in which that cell responds, the action potentials, and then we sort them. And in this case, sorted by pictures that are just flashed on the screen. And it turns out that it isn't incredibly difficult to find cells within this area of the temporal lobe that respond quite selectively to these pictures. And this got an entire movement some 40 or 50 years ago thinking about just how it is that this part of the brain and the cells within it participate in turning what is out there in the world, an object, into an internal representation of that object and ultimately into knowing that that object is there. And you can see why there would be excitement, at least at some level, because, well, it seems as if you were interested in finding pacifiers, this cell would be quite helpful in solving that kind of task. Now, along with that comes a lot of baggage, of course, about whether this really represents the pacifier or simply some cell that responds very well to an image of the pacifier. And we'll try to go through some of those issues today. Now, this ought to be near and dear to Terry. I'll give you a little credit here, Terry. When you think about approaching these problems, especially tying together systems and behavior to single units, for example, or activity at the level of small packages or collections of cells, it's a classic paper in the field, 88. I have to say, shocked me to think about that. I read this paper when it came out, which seems like it was yesterday. It turns out that it's, 22 years ago. That is completely outrageous. But nonetheless, the principles still hold. And this is figure one of a very well-known paper from Pat Churchill and Terry called Perspectives in Cognitive Neuroscience. Really, many ways ahead of its time, because as you'll see in the next slide, they were talking about things that were going to unfold over these past two decades, and sure enough have. Now, this map is a map of space in terms of, or it's a representation of space and the spatial scale at which you can look at these problems. Of course, for our purposes and for this center, we're kind of interested in a slightly different question, and that is, even if you have a scale that you think you might be interested in, like the scale of neurons, what about time? And so if you flip to figure three of that paper, you see this figure, which is also quite remarkable. It's remarkable for a couple of reasons. First of all, what the figure is it's about the spatial tool, the tools and techniques that are available at the time, around 1988, and showing them as a function of space and of time. And so here's that spatial scale. This is now the temporal scale on this axis. And these are the tools that were being used at the time. Notice there's a big void right here. And for most people in this room, or many people in this room, that void has been filled by a technique that was only just beginning at that time, functional imaging. And so that has been filled. But what I really want to focus on is this scale down here and the tools that I'm going to talk about today and how they map onto this scale. So mostly this level of analysis in terms of space, but this wide range, almost 10 orders of magnitude of time, and how we can think about that problem. And so really I kind of gave the title of the talk about temporal resolution or temporal scales and how it relates to physiology of behavior. And so then in seeing this slide, I wondered, would it be possible to look back over some of the work that we do and think about them over each of these timescales? Do we really cover this kind of range? Do we take advantage of the fact that this kind of tool might give us the ability to do so? So for the rest of the talk, what I want to kind of do is take a journey. It'll be a bit of a whirlwind journey, I must say, through these timescales. And sort of to guide us, I'll leave on the bottom here this map. It's now a map not of space, but of time, and of ways in which we can kind of hone in on different regions of this temporal map and see how we approach problems at those different timescales. All right, so we get started here with timescale number one, 10 to the first. Seems like a reasonable number to use. We're right here in the middle of the scale. This is about 10 seconds. What kind of things are you interested in about 10 seconds? And when I started working on this in this kind of area, one of the things that really interested me was how what we knew about activity of single cells could extend to behaviors that lasted a little bit longer than just a flash of a stimulus. So we began to explore extended visual behaviors, behaviors that, in fact, take time to unfold. If I show you a picture of a face, I mean, you see the face, and you stare at the face, and it just keeps being a face. But it's been known for quite some time that there are stimuli that don't quite do this, stimuli like this, where if I present them, your mind is at work. It's completely sort of, over time, trying to disambiguate something that's not quite settled. This would be an ambiguous figure that changes over time. The stimulus doesn't change over time, but your interpretation of it does. And so